Hey everyone, it's the Kung Fu Genius, aka Alex Richter. And if you're listening to us on audio only, I'd appreciate you rating and reviewing the podcast wherever you listen to it. And of course, if you like what I do here, don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius on YouTube and hit that bell for notifications. Are you a fan of Wing Chun Kung Fu? Well, if you listen to me, I assume you are. I got great news for Kung Fu Genius fans. Right now, you can get an all-access one-month free trial subscription to Wing Chun Illustrated Magazine. Yes, I said free. Go to WCINewsstand.com and register in the upper right-hand corner, fill in your email and password, and use the code KFGTRIAL to get your free trial to the issues from 2011 to the current issue. That's right, all the issues, even the one with this guy on the cover. My Kung Fu Genius column is in all the new issues, as if you need another reason to get this awesome magazine. Go get your free trial subscription today. For all that information, check out the description below. And with that, let's get started.
All right, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius will be answering all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube. Lots of gems, lots of Wing Chun uppercuts and hooks, lots of my sifu's the only sifu to learn that real stuff from that famous guy. Let's get to it!
He is unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Alex Richter, the Kung Fu Genius.
And every day, I practice martial arts. What's up? Word is, I'm a Kung Fu Genius. Practice
all day like a genius. Yo, Dre, how you doing, man?
I'm good, Sifu. What's happening over here?
What do you mean, what's happening? What are you talking about?
What's going on? You got, like, blazers? Are you here.
You talking about my jacket?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I recall last week when I showed up dressed up like a straight ass, you came with a jacket and your fancy shoes and everything like that, and then it's like, oh, wait a minute. Is this the way it's going to be now? I, the host of the Kung Fu Genius himself, yeah, is dressed like a total bum. You show up in a jacket, so I'm like, okay, now I see what it is. So, of course, I come
in
a jacket.
It was nothing. It was... I had to go to work after.
It was a dick move, Dre.
Okay.
It wasn't a dick
move. But what I don't understand is, we're recording this work on the same day as us. So you do not have work after the episode today? And dude, you work as a bouncer. What are you doing wearing suits?
I got a promotion.
You got a promotion? Yeah. What, are you the guy who looks at the video camera now?
I got to wear suits.
Got it. Pinstripe promotion. All right. So I see you're, you know, in a t-shirt and dog tags, and now I'm in a jacket. So I guess this is not a thing. I didn't want to come underdressed. I'm just going to put it to you that way.
Oh, you thought I was going to wear a suit again.
Yeah. All right. All right, cool. Well, you know what? I'm a Wing Chun practitioner. What do? I adapt according to what's going on, right? You wore a jacket. I thought, okay, now I need to wear a jacket. I wear a jacket, and you're dressed like a bum. That's all I need to know, all right? So we have another AMA episode today.
Yes, we do.
And let's get started.
We will get started with Marcus Tuck. Okay. Hi, KFG. Do you still progress further by taking lessons from other teachers? To my knowledge, many sifus stop taking lessons after they have founded their own lineage, probably because they are the best in their respective lineage anyway. Thanks in advance. Love your books and works for the Kung Fu community.
All right. Wow. Thank you very much. That's a great comment. Well, first of all, I just want to say I'm not the founder of my own lineage. That would be preposterous. All right. I learned from Sifu Leung Ting for a number of years. I was his representative here in New York for 9 years, but I was in his association for about 15 years. And when it broke away, because of politics and things like that, I still teach the Wing Chun that I learned from him. So it's not like, oh, this is now Alex Richter Wing Chun or something like that, right? I wouldn't be so presumptuous, A-R-W-T. Right? Yeah, exactly, right? Unlike many of my Sihings in Europe who decide to do their own thing and then now it's their version of Wing Chun or whatever. No, I mean, I still teach WT, so I still consider myself teaching what I learned from Sifu Leung Ting. I mean, that's where I learned my Wing Chun from. What have I done? I've updated a lot of the training methods and teaching methods, and tried to modernize things a little bit, but I certainly don't consider myself the founder of my own lineage or my own branch. That would be kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So that's like the first thing I have to say right there. Second is, of course, I continue to train. I think that, it's kind of a tired trope, I think, where it's like the instructor is really just a student who's further along down the road. It's like, yeah, obviously, right? When I see like high-level people post that as if that's some kind of mic-dropping revelation, it's like, no, bro, we're all still students, all right? The instructor who decides that they're not a student anymore, one, this is not the person you want to learn from, and two, this person is normally very sheltered from the outside world, right? You could be the best in your lineage, in your style, know everything about it, be tremendously skillful, but that doesn't mean that you wouldn't still try to explore or expand or improve things, right? Now, that doesn't always necessarily mean you need to go and learn from someone else directly or go learn a new style or do something totally different. There are lots of different ways to expand and explore. You can continue to do sparring with different training partners. You can explore with your high-level students. You can experiment with different things. I mean, learning martial arts ultimately is, it should be, for at least for the instructor, should be like a lab where you go and you test out things. You're trying to improve how you teach things. You know, we're constantly trying to improve how we do the self-defense aspect of what we teach here. Improving, like, for example, for many people in WT, they normally teach Chi Sao through something called sections. I've done away with sections, and I teach it more in a structured version of the pre-section time period in WT, because sections were really created to teach Wing Chun through seminars. Once an instructor knows the sections, you actually do not need the sections to teach to the students. But many WT people, instructors, still teach Chi Sao sections to their own students because that's how they learned it. But this was not meant to be a student program. It was meant to be a Rolodex for the instructor on all the different things they need to teach, right? So all I did was kind of standardize what I learned and kind of put it into kind of more bite-sized pieces. But in terms of my own training, I'm a martial arts fanatic, so obviously I love Wing Chun. Wing Chun is my wheelhouse, but anyone who's listened to this podcast for more than 8 minutes knows that I can talk about MMA, I can talk about mixed martial arts, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, karate, other Chinese kung fu styles, judo, wrestling, all these guys. I love martial arts, right?
MMA.
I loved MMA, right? Right. Real good. Have you seen
in
that?
Depth.
That George St. Tier, that guy's really good. Yeah. Right, and that is Silva Anderson, whatever GST. That guy is. Yeah, GST and Silva Anderson and
Spider-Man.
Yeah. Tito Henderson and all those guys, right? So, you know, and that's where I usually find myself a little bit of a loner in the Wing Chun world, because even among a lot of my other Wing Chun colleagues, we can talk about Wing Chun and we can talk around some of the peripheral topics, but I very rarely find a Wing Chun person that I can, like, discuss, you know, MMA with, or you know, the efficacy of certain methods compared to jiu-jitsu, because most people are so compartmentalized in their own wheelhouse. So since I left Sifu Leung Ting in 2011, I've continued to expand my horizons. And by the way, I was already doing that stuff while I was in Sifu Leung Ting's association. It's just that when I was a representative of the IWTA, it was very much frowned down upon to, you know, cross train and do things with other martial arts, because it might make it seem like the brand is missing something. And that was never my intention. When I was in the IWTA, already when I had my school, I'd done some training with Sifu Pauli Zink from Monkey Kung Fu, Dai Seng Pekwa, right?
Yeah.
Because he had this amazing and has this amazing style of yoga for martial arts. And he used to call it Taoist yoga at that time. And then later, I believe he called it Yin yoga or yin yang yoga or something like that, right?
Was he the guy that did the demo at your 15th?
No, that was his student Damon, and he was my first foray into that. And then I learned so much from Damon.
Okay.
And then also I had the chance to meet Pauli Zink, who was one of my childhood idols from the martial art magazines, and learn a lot about different ways of looking at movement and mobility. So it wasn't just about learning to become more flexible or to stretch or something like that. But Damon in particular taught me a lot about things that I didn't really pay attention to, like ankle mobility and how that affects how well you can kick. Now, luckily, I already had that because of my background in Taekwondo. But those bits and pieces solved a lot of things for me when I would look at certain students and wonder why there was something off about the way they kicked or the way they moved. And I learned a tremendous amount from my experience with Damon Honeycutt and with Pauly Zink. That was huge in terms of changing how I looked at martial arts from a movement perspective, right? But also, in that time, I, you know, would look at what other kung fu guys were doing. I usually kept it more into the Chinese martial arts. After 2011, I started to explore more into what other people were doing, you know, training with different Brazilian jiu-jitsu instructors, you know, training with different kickboxing instructors, and you know, kind of like measuring up different methods and how to use this to better improve what I do. Now, I've two very big influences in my in how I present Wing Chun post learning from actually I should say I have three big influences since leaving the Leung-Ting organization. Okay, one is Mak Chi Kong, Mak Si Fu, from the Hong Kun style in Hong Kong, right? Mak Si Fu, who I've talked about many times before, is a Hong Gar master from Hong Kong. What's really rare about him is he's not only fantastic in Hong Kun, like his ability to perform the forms and break them down and show you what it's really for. A lot of people, in my experience from a lot of traditional martial arts styles, can do really cool forms. But when you say, okay, how is this used in fighting? Sometimes they'll show you stuff where you go, are you sure about that, right? But Mak Si Fu really knows and really has a very good understanding of how these mechanics and how these things apply from the form to actual fighting and how these things need to be translated slightly differently, but the movements and the elements are in there. He was the first person to show me, you know, for example, in certain Hong Kun forms, they do it lower, they move their arms this way, but in fighting, it's a lot shorter and a lot more narrow. And he is also one of the few Chinese martial arts practitioners at that level who is not completely tribal about his style, all right? Usually people who are at that level, it's like their style and F the rest. Mak Si Fu, you can have conversations with him about Wing Chun, which is a style that he did learn before he did Hong Kun, but it's obviously not his specialty. But he knows a lot more about Wing Chun than some Wing Chun people I've talked to. And he told me a lot about the origins of Lok Ting Bun Guan and the knives and how this interrelates with other Southern styles and the difference between Southern and Northern styles and the signatures. I had a basic understanding of that stuff before I met Mak Si Fu, but after I met Mak Si Fu, he really like opened my mind to look at Chinese martial arts more collectively and realize that the different martial arts styles specialize in a different corner, but you can kind of see the origins of our martial DNA in these different styles. And, you know, and also because of the Ba Cham Do we have in Wing Chun, you know, we have to do that against different types of weapons. Most Wing Chun people don't know how to use any other weapon besides the ones they have in Wing Chun. And I would argue many Wing Chun people don't even do the two Wing Chun weapons that well. I wanted to know a little bit more about the other weapons that Wing Chun is fighting against, because it's kind of like in Wing Chun, we learn how to defend a roundhouse kick, right? Well, most Wing Chun people cannot throw a roundhouse kick if they didn't come from a karate or taekwondo background, right? That's why when I teach you guys this stuff, I kick you guys because I have a black belt in taekwondo. I know a lot of your training partners can't give you a roundhouse kick that doesn't look completely embarrassing, right? So I put the shin pads on and I kick you guys and see if you can stop my kick, right? All right, Lao Kirk, right? So it's the same thing. But if you look for the weapons, we have the same problem, right? It's like, okay, the let's say the fifth set of the Ba Cham Do is meant to teach you against some kind of overhand or overhead movement with a broadsword, okay? Well, how many Wing Chun people actually know how to wield a broadsword? I'm not saying like an expert, but with basic ass competency, right?
To balance and, it out.
Right. Yeah, so when you see like Wing Chun people showing their awesome Ba Cham Do techniques against broadsword or whatever, the guy holding the broadsword just throws it like a noob, and it's like, dude, did you even need Wing Chun to defend that dumbass attack, right? So I wanted to actually learn some broadsword techniques, and so Mak Si Fu taught me a northern broadsword form, which is in the Hong Kun style, Pekwar Tan Do, and it's amazing, and it's so much fun to practice, and it's just cool to do something a little bit different, and it made me realize, if I had a broadsword in my hand versus a clone of me with the double knives, I would kill the version of me with the double knives. And I'm not even good at the broadsword yet. But what I realized is once I learned a few things about the broadsword, I go, oh, fighting with the double knives against a broadsword. Yeah, you have to close the gap and you have to get in. And I understand how it's supposed to work in theory. But I'm pretty sure if you had two Alex Richter clones, one with a broadsword and one with Ba Cham Do, the one with the broadsword would cut the head off the other one. All right. So I cannot beat myself with a broadsword, how am I going to fare against someone who actually really knows how to use a broadsword well, right? But those are things I wouldn't know. I'd be like, well, someone, had I not met Maxivo, I'd be like, someone attacks you with this, you just do and then you're fine. Someone does this, you do and you're fine. Now that I learned a little bit about a broadsword, I go, ooh. If someone's got a broadsword and I got the bachamdo, I'm going to throw those things and grab my long pole and poke the guy while I'm running away. Like, that's my new strategy, right? So Maxivo really opened my mind to Chinese martial arts as a collective. And I, every time I go to Hong Kong, I learn from him. I see what he does. And I he's just a nonstop, never-ending kind of source of both inspiration and martial arts knowledge.
You do hold him in high regard.
I absolutely love him, and he's fantastic. And of course, my nickname is the Kung Fu Genius because of, you know, the whole thing in the Hong Kong press a number of years back, and my war with Siva Leung Ting at some point. It's not without complete irony that I call myself the Kung Fu Genius. Like I said, I'm not even in the top 15 of people I know in terms of martial arts knowledge. If there's a real Kung Fu genius, it's Maxivo. It's not me, right? So he's first influence post my Siva Leung Ting career. Second influence, I would have to say, are the Valenti brothers in Miami. Mm. The Valenti brothers teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but they don't really call it Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. They just call it Jiu-Jitsu. They learn from Helio Gracie. And what's interesting about them is they teach it in a slightly more, I'm not going to say traditional way, because it's actually very modern, their approach. The way they teach things there is, in my opinion, one of the best ways to present any martial art. When you go there, you know, you learn, they focus on self-defense when you're a beginner. And the first 5-10 minutes of the practice is just go ahead and practice all the self-defense stuff you know with a partner. And you do it in a free-form and playful way so that you constantly reinforce these things. Then after that, they have a warm-up. And then they do like maybe 2 to 3 techniques in a class where you just drill down on those things. And once you can do those things, then, you know, you get your blue belt. And then they also have separate sparring classes for striking and grappling. And the way that they do it both kind of merges the jiu-jitsu philosophy, which is great. You don't always see that in modern BJJ schools. Practical self-defense. So not just talking about, oh, it's just ground fighting. It's like people grabbing, throwing, trying to grab you, throw swings at you, punches, kicks, you're on the wall, someone attacks you. They address all of these kind of things, and they do it in such a professional way. And the Valenti brothers themselves, all right, Pedro and Guy especially, they are such upright people. And I love them to death. Every time I go to Miami, I try to train with them. The last couple of years, I didn't have time because it was just so busy. And I really miss it. I think they're fantastic. And a lot of the things that they do in their school, I've rearranged some of the things we do here at City Wing Chun to follow that. For example, the fact that we open with the self-defense. Yeah. We have that warm-up. Okay, our Wing Chun warm-up, I took their jiu-jitsu warm-up and I modified it to Wing Chun techniques. But this is 100% the influence of the Valenti brothers, right? And the students like this new format. And so I've used that to adapt a little bit. The way they do it, the atmosphere there is amazing. So the Valenti brothers, even if they don't know it, have been a huge influence in the way I present stuff. And then third, of course, is Magno Gama, who's a student of Henzo's, who ran a school in Astoria for the longest time. Good friend of mine. And, you know, having the chance to do private training with him, you're really focusing on kind of modern Brazilian jiu-jitsu, not so much the self-defense aspect, but like kind of what they're doing nowadays with leg locks and stuff like that. That totally, like, the martial arts geek of me side of me is so like I love that stuff, right? Because the level of Brazilian jiu-jitsu that they're doing nowadays with all the modern leg locks and how all of this stuff goes in, whether it's gi or no gi, that is like kung fu in grappling because it's so intricate. And so like this counters this, counters this. And I love it. So I would say like kind of post my career with Siva Leung Ting, I would say those are my three biggest influences, right? And I'm perfectly fine with that. So yes, I do continue to train and improve myself.
Love it. Love it, man. Love it. That's dope. Next up, we got Harley Davidson. I mean, no, Harley Rogers. Oh. Forgive me.
It was close.
Misprint.
Misprint?
Misread.
Or misread, right?
Blame it.
My co-host, ladies and gentlemen.
Never blame it on me. Yeah. All right. Dr. Peter Wu and Dr. Langford believed Bruce died from the hash. Davis Miller said Bruce got the hash from Nepal, which is unrefined. He had 1% body fat and couldn't absorb anything, and he removed his sweat glands, which would have excreted any toxins from the hash. It's not heat stroke because I'm sure Betty Tang had AC in her house, because we all know, right? Yeah. He died by mistake, but he died from the hash. Mm-hmm. I trust his doctors that were there over anyone else. Yep. The hash and the sweat glands are the only thing that killed him. Your thoughts?
That's great. So a couple things about that. The hash being the cause of his death is a long kind of bandied about theory. I think that there's something to it.
I'm wondering if I ever took hash, though. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. I think you took hash before this episode.
you ever did hash?
Oh my God, I smoked hash for the majority of my teens and my early 20s.
You're still here.
I feel so unqualified to do these episodes, right?
Drugs.
All these questions always come up on drugs, and yeah. It's like, don't ask me, ask these two dudes right here. Yeah, these dudes know what's
really
going on.
Taking a lot of drugs in my time.
Look, I have.
Uh-huh. We gotta do an episode with this guy in my place. He can answer all the drug questions, right? You
know, pre-20s, I did a lot of drugs.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so anyway.
16 to 18.
So this thing comes out a lot because, first of all, as we've discussed many times before on this very podcast, Bruce had two similar incidents, right? He had the May 10th incident where he collapsed during a dubbing session at Golden Harvest.
Right.
And then, of course, the final incident, which is when he passed away. These two incidences, at least the way it's described by the people who were there, are more or less identical. Bruce had brain swelling during the May 10th incident, but they were able to get him to the hospital in time, and they were able to administer mannitol and, you know, get him the brain swelling down and so on. The second time, they did not get him to the hospital in time, and he died. So essentially, you have two identical.
If you would have carried him.
If I would have carried him, it would have been different, right?
Been, yeah.
5 minutes.
Yeah.
I put all 120 pounds of Bruce on my back. Yeah, I could run him to Baptist University or Baptist Hospital before the ambulance got there. I should have been there. Yeah. So too bad. These time machine things don't work, right? So anyway, we have these two incidences that are essentially equal on paper from at least as far as we understand. I mean, look, we are all pontificating here. We're all armchair doctors here when we're not qualified to even diagnose a cold, okay? So anyway, anyone who takes my medical opinion on anything needs to get their head checked, okay? the Kung Fu Genius said this about, you know, Bruce's autism. It's like, I'm a dude who likes Bruce Lee, all right? Not a pathologist, not a doctor. And if you're listening to what I say is the authority on anything about Bruce Lee's death, you're an idiot, okay?
There is one authority on the internet, though, about Bruce Lee.
Shut your mouth. Shut
Does
your...
Does he have a beard?
Shut...
I'm pretty sure.
Both of you.
Does he drink beer?
Both of you.
Does he have beer in his beard?
He says he's from the UK, right?
He has beer in his beard.
Yeah, beer in his beard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His beard is weird, all right? So anyway. can I finish my thought, please, before constantly getting interrupted by this nonsense from you two. All right. So anyway, Bruce has these two incidences that are equal on paper. All right. Now, the second one, he doesn't make it to the doctor in time and he dies. All right.
Jeez.
The one thing that is common in both incidences is that he had hash in his stomach because he would ingest it. He would eat it either through brownies or direct or what. I don't know shit about drugs, okay? But I know that he would eat it. Now, the weird thing is people say he preferred to ingest it, but then there are other quotes that said he was smoking like weed, like seven joints a day. So I don't know. He obviously did smoke at some point because people talked about that. But then later they said, no, he actually preferred to ingest it because he didn't want to smoke. But then there are other people like, no, he was like, according to some doctor in the inquest, he was smoking like seven joints a day. I'm like, are you like, what? Crazy. Can you imagine talking to Bruce Lee? He's smoking seven joints in one day. Man, that would be crazy, right?
So I
don't know how true that is because I don't know how he would have otherwise gotten through his schedule if he was smoking that much. But anyway, Bruce had hash in his system on both times, right? He had it in the May 10th collapse and he had it on, they found it in his stomach during the autopsy. But then, so you look at Occam's razor, okay? The you have to make the least amount of assumptions and see which one is, that one is probably correct. If this is the only thing that was present in both instances, then you would tend to think that that might have had something to do with his death. But because for whatever reason, they're like, no, it was the equagesic, the mill town, all right, the aspirin with that meprobamate in it.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you go, okay, but he didn't have that in his system on May 10th that we know of. And people are like, oh, well, he was hypersensitive to it. Well, here's the problem with that. In November, when he went to see the doctor, the previous November, 72, when he went to see the doctor about the sweat glands and the problem with the weight loss, after he had that procedure, the doctor prescribed to him Milltown. And Milltown is the brand name of meprobamate.
Mm-hmm.
So Bruce had already had a history of taking that pill. So why did, so because they make it seem like, you know, Betty just gave him this pill when he had a headache and, oh, whoops, he was hypersensitive and we didn't know. Bruce was, had already been taking that. He had a history of it. Now, does that mean he, you know, couldn't have still had a reaction later? I don't know. I'm not a medical, I don't know anything about medicine, all right? Don't take my, I'm just telling you what I know, right? Seriously, if anyone quotes me on anything about his death, you need to get your head checked, okay? I wasn't even a piece of protein in my dad's hamburger in July of 1973, so please, okay? Please.
Damn.
All right? I'm operating with as much information as anyone else who has Google can find out, right? So it's not like, oh, the KFG, he knows some shit I don't know, okay? No, all right? I don't. I'm an idiot, okay?
So anyway. In my dad's hamburger.
Yes, I'm an idiot in my dad's hamburger, all right? So anyway. So he had already had a history of taking this. So how can then suddenly that then be the cause for it when that was supposedly not present during the May 10th collapse? But the thing that was present both times was the hash. Now, in the recent documentary on the History Channel, but like the death of Bruce Lee, they did explore whether he might have had some kind of overdose or something like that. Now, for everyone who goes like, oh, they didn't find cocaine in the toxicology report, I have a copy of his autopsy, okay? I don't know shit about shit. Let's just, if one thing is clear about this episode, I don't know shit about shit, all right? But I'll tell you what, I didn't see anything about cocaine in the toxicology report. Okay. Nothing, not nothing, okay? So people are like, oh, they didn't find that in there. You can't find what you're not looking for, all right? That's all I'm going to say about that, all right?
Man.
So we leave the cocaine thing off the shelf right now, okay? Because the revelations with the drug letters or whatever, that changes everything. You know, regular cocaine use breaks the blood-brain barrier, which we have discussed before, and cerebral edema is a common cause of death among people who use cocaine, even in small amounts. So it's kind of like rolling the dice. You don't know how you're going to react. I've been looking lately at some studies about people who have death from cocaine. And a relatively sizable proportion of people literally dropped dead from cerebral edema, which is what Bruce had. So if they didn't, so again, you know, and I always thought that the May 10th collapse, it came on the heels of an April or March letter that Linda sent to Bob Baker where he asked for $500 worth of cocaine.
Yeah.
So if you look at May 10th, in my estimation, that would have been that order went, that order came in. Bruce is now sitting on, in 1973 dollars, $500 worth of cocaine. And he had finished Enter the Dragon. And that would, in my estimation, just from the timeline. And look, I could be totally wrong. I'm not saying that's what happened. Just you look at the letters. When would this order come in? Let's give it 4 weeks, whatever. Okay. That's around the time of the May 10th collapse. So Bruce may have just received, pardon my French, a whole bunch of shit from Bob Baker.
Too.
And there he went a little bit overboard, damn, right? And of course there he's having extreme weight loss, another sign of regular cocaine use. So I'm a little more partial to cocaine being a factor because I don't really see that being tested in the toxicology report of his autopsy. But the other thing would be the hash. Now, who knows? Could be a combination of the two. So to come back to what the question talked about, the hash that Bruce got at the time was from Nepal, and that stuff was unrefined. You can do some research, not that what you find on Google is authoritative, but it's true. The hash that was used in Hong Kong at that time, they got it from Nepal, and it was unrefined, most likely made in not the most sanitary conditions, and it's possible that he could have received some bad stuff. and, you know, through no fault of his own, could have had a reaction to it, because it is the only thing that we know definitively that was in his system in both cases. So obviously we cannot say anything conclusive, but hell, I'll tell you what, there could be something there.
I'd like to say that I doubt it personally, but that's me.
Yeah. It's possible, but I'm a little more partial to the cocaine.
Cocaine is a hell of a drug.
Mm-hmm. By the way, that's a great soundbite. The KFG. I'm actually a little more partial to the cocaine.
God damn. God, I hate both you guys. The moment this podcast makes money, I'm firing both your asses. I'm going to hire a proper professional crew.
Oh, no.
Someone who can read and someone without a British accent.
This is going to be great to
All
see.
Right, what do we got next? Hey, Kung Fu Genius listeners, if you're a Wing Chun practitioner, especially from the WT or Leung Ting line, and want to get really personalized immersion training with me, you can now apply to do an immersion course with me here in NYC, or if you like the sun, in my Florida home near Orlando. These courses are for instructors or anyone who's serious about learning the art in detail and working hard. I teach in program blocks like Siunam Tao, Cham Kyu, Byuji, Wooden Dummy, and those include the Chi Sao theory, fighting applications, and training methods as well. If you're really serious about learning Wing Chun, check out the link in the description below to find out about applying for a spot. For those of you who are not quite ready to do full private immersion training, you can also apply for a spot at either our winter or summer intensive training camps. We have a few spots available for non-city Wing Chun students, so apply today. A link for those options are in the description below. And now back to me.
All right, Axel Stone. Cool name, Axel. What if Bruce Lee was in the Matrix?
As who? Morpheus?
I don't know. Who
Who else? Matrix came out, what, in 98?
99. Yeah. March 31st.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce would have been, what, in his 50s at that point, right?
Morpheus. So,
I think the problem is when people say, like, yeah, what if Bruce was in this? And then they name some movie from, like, the 90s. It's like, you realize he's not 32 years old in the 90s.
Right.
Right? Okay, right, so you have to kind of put that.
Definitely. Oh, Trinity.
Trinity was in her 20s back then.
Yeah, you're right. No, Morpheus.
Yeah. Take it easy. All right. Yeah, I think as a Morpheus character, he would have been cool. Maybe even just in a cameo as Seraph, you know, in the second one where he fights on the table.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which was played by Colin Cho, who's from the Sammo Hung stunt team.
I protect those that matter most.
Yeah. So, it's interesting. I mean, look, you know, the whole what if of like Bruce Lee and what would have been. I mean, you don't know what his career trajectory would have been. But I'll tell you what, had Bruce not died, he would not be the Bruce Lee, this legendary figure. Because no one is really that way while they're alive.
Yeah.
All right? Because what would have eventually happened if Bruce kept making movies? He eventually would have made a couple shit films. You know, where people were just like, oh man, I'm getting tired of this cat screams and kicks and what and all that kind of stuff.
Watch this, dude,
yeah, because
right now.
You know, at some point, like when something gets big, then eventually it gets played out. All right? And then Bruce decides, like, well, I'm not going to do these things anymore. I'm going to go more on the philosophical end of it, all right? Now, one thing not a lot of people know, maybe you've seen The Warrior's Journey, the documentary about all the uncut footage from Game of Death, all right? Someone I know, we saw, Alan Canvin. Remember, he took all that footage and then he kind of put it together a little bit more in the way maybe Bruce would have seen it. Do you remember watching that? I think what a lot of people don't realize about what Bruce had shot for Game of Death, you know, he had a basic treatment. He didn't really have a script. And people argue with me in the comments all the time because they don't understand the difference between a treatment, which is like an outline, and an actual fleshed out script.
Right.
Okay, because even on the day of his death, they were supposedly, whether you want to believe it or not, trying to figure out how to shoehorn George Lazenby into the movie.
Mm.
So if you're trying to like, hey, let's shoehorn the guy who played Bond once because he's kind of a star right now, then we're not talking about there's a fully fleshed out script when you can just shoehorn some dude in there, right? And oh, maybe we'll get a role for Betty or something like that, all right? Yeah, this is not a fully fleshed out, ready to go thing, right? So a treatment is like a paragraph or a page, a basic outline of a story.
What do you think Lazenby would have been?
Who the hell knows? The thing is, we don't really know. It's basically Bruce is in Bruce's original idea. He's like a retired martial arts champion. And then I think that his sister gets kidnapped and taken to Korea, and there's this pagoda in Korea, mm-hmm. And then he's got to go up and he's got to fight each one, and it's a basic metaphor for his Jeet Kune Do philosophy, where as he goes up, which is essentially the genesis of video games, going up and fighting it. A tough until you get the final boss, right? Like Bruce was already kind of on way that tip back then, right? Start. But beyond that, I mean, there's really not a whole lot. If you say that there was a script for Game of Death, mm-hmm. That's, I think, pushing it a little bit. There was maybe a treatment at best, okay? So when we saw that uncut footage, it was, what, about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, and Matt Pauly was there, and then we watched it. I don't know if you remember, but in between, like during the fights, there were these long expositionary bits of dialogue where Bruce is explaining Jeet Kune Do philosophy. You know, like, oh, you know, like, and some people have seen, oh, this bamboo is flexible, da 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 da. But that was in every scene, and some of those bits were long-winded. Yeah. And you start to look at this and you go, like, Bruce just wanted to use his platform as a movie star to kind of showcase how enlightened and philosophical Jeet Kune Do was. But when you watch all of that uncut footage, where they added the dialogue, and it was interesting because I don't know if you remember, there were a couple bits of dialogue because it's shot without sound,
yeah.
where he didn't know what Bruce Lee was saying. And then what did he do? He hired a professional lip reader. Remember when he told me that? He said there was one line, even in the John Little documentary, where they were like, we don't know what he's saying. It says, like, you know, unknown or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And Alan hired a professional lip reader, and they figured out what Bruce was saying. Right. And then he dubbed that line in there, right? But you look at it and you go, like, oh, I'll tell you one thing, all right? If Bruce left all of that stuff in the Game of Death, besides the fight scenes, it would have been a bit of a stinker, I'll tell you. It would
have been the movie of death.
Yeah, the movie of death, because he's just like kind of like, you know, Jeet Kune Do philosophy, like talking about Jeet Kune Do philosophy, and oh, and you have to be flexible, and it comes off super preachy. Mm. And Silent Flute was also supposed to be a metaphor for Jeet Kune Do, as was Lam Kun Bak Thoi, which was these Southern Fist, Northern Kicks, which was another treatment he had, which was these were all just metaphors for him to talk about the Jeet Kune Do philosophy. And so had Bruce Lee not died, he might have had some very long-winded, preachy movies about opening your mind and all that kind of stuff that, you know, one or two of those, you would have been like, oh, Jesus, man, can you just punch someone's face in, please?
Right.
So who knows? I mean, like, you know, so by the time, you know, the Matrix came around, people would be like, oh, man, you're putting Bruce Lee in there? Yeah. Like, you know what I mean?
This guy.
Yeah, exactly, right? You know, just like Elvis died about 5 years too late, all right? About five, and he's still a big star, but he died, let's admit, about 5 years too late.
Belly.
Yeah. All right.
Damn.
Next one.
Damn. All right. Butcher Wing 100.
Butcher Wing.
Butcher Wing.
Mm-hmm. Juyok Wing.
Oh.
You know, Butcher Wing. Magnificent Butcher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about the effective street fighting methods he taught his Seattle students that he didn't share in later years? I'm assuming he's talking about
Bruce Lee.
Gary. Oh. Okay. Gary Elms? No.
Uh-huh.
I believe Leo Fong stated he decided not to share the most effective techniques so no one knew how to beat him. Tim Tackett said only a few were prepared to put in the training time to perfect simple techniques rather than learning lots of techniques. Mm-hmm. Thanks and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. I agree with what Tim Tackett says there. Like, there are very few people who are really willing to put in the time. I mean, it's not just, you know, getting good at martial arts is not just a matter of acquiring technical knowledge. You can have an idea, let's say from a boxing perspective, if someone gives you this punch, how you're supposed to move your head and counter, and you can technically know how to do all those things. But it's another thing if you have gloves on and now those punches are really coming at your head, can you actually apply the stuff that you know in your head, right? All knowledge begins as an idea in your brain. But in order for it to become a skill, you need to transfer that idea into something that you can actually do, right? So I think there are a lot of people who understand to a certain degree how this stuff works, but are you going to put in the time to work that technique again and again and again, whether it's offensive or defensive or footwork or hands or legs or whatever? And so that is always the X factor, because we have so much access to information now that anyone can essentially say what you're supposed to do, but it's a matter of, are you going to put in the time to actually do it? So I agree with what Tim Tackett says there. In terms of him quoting Leo Fong, I don't think it was actually Leo Fong who said that. I think it was actually the late James DeMille.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a common thing in martial arts. And I'm not saying that what either Leo or what James said is not true. But everyone believes that if there's a famous master, whether it's Bruce Lee or Yip Man or Helio Gracie or whoever it is,
mm-hmm.
most people who learn from these famous masters or who are descendants from people who learn from these famous masters always believe that the time period in which they learned was the only real time period where that person showed, pardon my French, the real shit, okay? So Bruce essentially had like kind of, let's say, three phases, okay? He had his early Seattle period, all right, when he was kind of first in the States and developing that. Let's say more of a middle period, Oakland, that time period, James M. Lee that time. And then his latter teaching period, Los Angeles, you know, Ted Wong, Dan Inosanto, those guys, right? So you had three schools, and you can almost say there's like three epochs or three periods of him teaching, all right? You will never, all right? Now, they might not say it publicly, all right? But when you hang out with these dudes privately, all right? And I've hung out with dudes from all three of those, you know, descendants from all three of those time periods, all right? The dudes from the Seattle era, or descendants of dudes from that time, are going to tell you, well, when he was teaching in Seattle, he was still much closer to his Wing Chun roots. So he was teaching a lot of like the core Wing Chun principles and ideas and, you know, forward pressure and all of these kind of things that he didn't emphasize later. So actually only the Seattle guys really know how to use his proper pressure Chi Sao and the punches and the Wing Chun elements in a way that is really effective, because that was closer to the time when he was doing that stuff. And also the thing that when Bruce would ever get in a real fight, purportedly, he'd always revert back to Wing Chun. So yeah. The Seattle guys are going to tell you, well, we're the ones that actually really learned the Bruce Lee Wing Chun. And even later when he was, you know, dancing around like Muhammad Ali, when the fight got serious, even Dan Inosanto said he would always revert back to Wing Chun.
Right.
So we're the only ones that got the Wing Chun. So maybe openly they're not going to say it, but amongst themselves, they'd be like, yeah, you know, later in Oakland and in Los Angeles, he wasn't really teaching the Wing Chun in that much detail, and he was keeping a lot of secrets. Then you go to the Oakland guys, and they're going to be like, well, he had his famous fight with Wong Jack Man at that time. And that's when he decided, because of his conditioning or whatever it was, that he needed to change what he was doing. So they're going to look, oh, the Seattle guys, they're doing that old shit that he realized at some point that was no good anymore and had to create Jeet Kune Do because Wong Jack Man ran away from him for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay? So then they're like, we're the most important era, because that was when Bruce decided to change everything and to change up the way that he was doing things. And he did that with a lot of influence from James M. Lee and the guys who were around there at that time. And then, of course, the L.A. Chinatown people are going to be like, well, or just L.A. in general, not just Chinatown. Like, well, this is the latter portion of his teaching career. So at that point, he had already refined a lot of the things he did in the earlier period. And he was mixing in more ideas from, let's say, boxing and fencing, and he had the chance to experiment with these ideas more and see what other martial artists were doing, because when he was in LA, he had connections to Black Belt magazine, so he naturally had the chance to see other martial artists and Jun Ri and all of these people, right? So of course LA is going to represent his most refined stage, because now he's had a chance to do all these things for a few years. But what you're going to find is the LA guys are basically going to look at either Oakland or Seattle as lesser unrefined versions of what Bruce was doing. The Seattle period is going to look at later versions as watered down versions of what he was doing. So you have this in the Bruce. Now, they don't always say that openly. And there's some people in the Jeet Kune Do world, to their credit, who look at all three of those periods as equally good for different reasons and also want to learn what Bruce was doing in those three different periods, right? Mm-hmm. I think if you're a Bruce Lee fanatic and you really want to understand the nature of Jeet Kune Do, if that was my path, I would make sure that I had learned the best of what he taught from the best guys in Seattle. the best of what he taught in Oakland and the best of what he taught in Los Angeles before you start to make an opinion about what's better or what's what, because it's different phases, and Bruce may have been experimenting with other things in Los Angeles and not experimenting with other things that he already could do at that time. So maybe there is something that in LA he wasn't teaching as much Wing Chun stuff, because for him, he was already really good at it. He wanted to improve the stuff he wasn't good at yet. So it is possible that the LA guys didn't learn as much Wing Chun for that reason. But that also could be a total red herring and bullshit, okay? The problem is you can easily reason this stuff after the fact. And if you're partial to this group, you're going to say this more. And partial to the other group, you're going to say that more, all right? Same thing in Yip Man Wing Chun. Yip Man Wing Chun, you hear early period, middle period, and final period, right?
Just thinking about that.
And the early period, people are going to say, well, this is the only time when Yip Man was really teaching by hand himself and trying to, you know, make these guys into fighters to forge a reputation for Wing Chun. The middle period students are going to be like, well, because Yip Man already had a reputation, the Wing Chun style had a reputation, the middle period guys could learn more of the techniques in detail, because the original period guys, they just had to learn to fight in order to fight with the other guy. I'm not saying I agree with this. This is just one of many before people can, yeah, actually in the first period, yeah. Shut up. All right. I don't care. All right. I've heard every iteration of this. Okay. All right. In the first period, yeah, he was very technical and taught all this. Okay. Yeah. I've also heard that version too. Take it easy. Right. I'm just saying one narrative. One narrative is in the early period, he focused more on getting these guys ready to fight. In the middle period, he focused, now that he had a reputation for a style, he could open up more about some of the advanced stuff and some of the stuff in more detail. And then some people say in the third period, well, he wasn't teaching that much. He was sick. He was retired. And so he wasn't really strong enough to teach anyone. And other people say, well, during this period, he maybe wasn't as physical, but he was more willing to teach things in a lot more detail, maybe perhaps, ready for his inevitable demise, right? So if you're from the first period, or you're a descendant of someone who learned from the first period, guess what your narrative is going to be? Well, this was the only time period where Yip Man really taught, and those guys are always the best. Okay. Wow. And if your Sifu happened to come from the middle period, all right, or you're descended from the middle period, guess what your narrative is going to be? Mm. All right. Well, that was the time when it was more technical and those guys could learn a lot more or whatever. And if you're a descendant from someone from the final period, well, Yip Man, knowing that he was inevitably going to die soon, he wanted to make sure that he got all this stuff out there and taught some students who would be able to continue Wing Chun after he passed away.
Bruce Lee is from the middle period,
roughly. Yeah, well, I mean, it all depends because, again, and that is even something that, look, all of that stuff... Yip Man taught for 22 years. He just started teaching, and then eventually he passed away in 72. Started teaching around 1950, and he passed away in 72. Now, mind you, he wasn't teaching as actively in the last few years, but let's give it that he was still more or less active until he died, right? So 22 years, all right? When you teach, like I've been teaching now, it's going to be our 20-year anniversary next year. So I've almost taught as long as Yip Man taught in his entire career.
Yo.
All right. But hopefully I'm going to teach much longer than that. Right. All right. But hey, if I drop dead tomorrow, all right, then you have to look back into time, and someone is going to have to decide when is the early period, when is the middle period, and when is the latter period.
Yeah.
And is that solely divided by you take the entire time someone taught and divide that by three? Okay, and then you just go first period, middle period, final period? Or do you actually look at the phases of how someone taught in those different time periods, right? So the labeling first period, middle period, second period, all that stuff is done after the Sifu is dead, because until they're dead, you don't know how long they taught.
Yeah.
All right? Yeah. So there's no, like, there wasn't at some point in 1960 where Yip Man goes, I am now in my middle period of teaching, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So exactly where that middle period starts, okay, even that is going to be up for debate, because most people want to be in the first period.
This could be still your first period.
Who knows? All right? You never know, right?
Yeah.
But I would think it probably should be more judged in phases.
Mm-hmm.
So if we judge it in the phases of my teaching, to use me as an example,
okay.
I'm like in the fifth phase of teaching right now.
Oh,
all right.
Man.
Because when I first started teaching, I was still heavily influenced by what I had learned in Europe for the first few years. So I was still teaching a very European oriented Wing Chun for the first few years. Then I started to learn more from Sifu Leung Teng, and I started to change to a more Hong Kong style. Right. And then I have my whole post IWTA phase where,
wow,
you know, I had changed the programs, done this or whatever. So I think it should be more in phases based on how the Sifu taught, not just divided by three as if there's some kind of demarcation that means anything there. Right.
Mm.
So everyone is going to say that. I know that James DeMille complained he had an observation that he had seen some students in LA at some point, and he noticed that Bruce was not focusing on the heavy forward pressure style Chi Sao, which was such a big part of what he had done in the Seattle era. And he had mentioned that to Bruce, and then Bruce said something like, well, why would I teach someone to beat me, right? That's a story that I heard. Now, the late James DeMille, I met him, I talked about that. He was an absolute gentleman to me, right? But I've also heard that him and Bruce were not even really on speaking terms after he left Seattle. So did this conversation happen? So I don't know. And I'm not trying to say one thing or another. So the problem is, when it comes to Kung Fu, when it comes to all this stuff, all of us, myself included, I'm telling you a story that's like third hand by the time it comes to me. That's why I try to hedge it by saying, look, I don't know if it's 100% true,
yeah.
All right? This is something I heard, or it is said, right? But to take what I say about these things and be like, no, this is exactly how it happened, I don't think you should do that with anyone, not just me included. You have to look at all of the stories collectively and see the overlap. And the overlap is usually something closer to the truth.
Like the classic game, iPhone.
iPhone.
Telephone.
Telephone, the classic game from the 60s, iPhone.
Wow.
Yeah, seriously.
That's the game.
I'm pretty sure iPhone would be played via tech. Like,
imagine.
It would be a lot harder to screw
I think, you know, I think I know what that game is, the iPhone game.
What?
The iPhone game is you write a text,
mm-hmm.
all right? But you go to Google Translate, translate it into another language, then translate it back in English.
Oh,
it's never the same.
Yeah.
Then you send that. The person sends their response, translates it to another language, back to English, sends that.
You
that's
have
the
to
game
translate
of,
it.
That's
you
the
have,
game of
okay.
iPhone.
I thought
Got
the
it.
Game of iPhone is where like the co-host buys a more expensive phone with a better camera.
Yeah, exactly. until the actual host buys the real phone.
Yeah, absolutely. Because he's
golly.
All right, let's go.
All right. Next up, we got someone we haven't had in a little while. We haven't heard from in a little while. Topher.
Topher. Nice. Yeah.
Topher. Topher, our boy. All right. Hey, Alex Sifu. I hope you are well. What are a few WCWT books you recommended outside of your own for practitioners to read? Thank you.
Good. I only recommend my books. Kung Fu Genius books are available at citywt.com. Get yours today. And by the way, speaking of books, shameless plug,
yes.
I just finished the rough draft of
yes.
the Wooden Dummy book,
yes.
which is going to Mikey Dean very shortly for proofreading.
Proofread? I thought it was going to me.
No. You can't even read the book, let alone proof it.
Oh, no, he's got to proofread it for different, areas, different
yeah.
regions.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? So
got
we're
it.
Gonna, we're going to proofread it
for Harlem.
Bronx.
You're going to proofread it for Brooklyn. All right?
For Med-Stop.
Yo, Sifu, there's not enough F-bombs
there's
in this book
enough.
Here. Right?
Where's the F-bomb that goes in here?
That's
what
right.
happened?
So the Wooden Dummy book is going to be proofed. And
proofread the pictures?
And we should have the pre-sale ready by December.
Yes.
All right. So the Wooden Dummy book,
yes.
which by the time this episode comes out might be after that. I don't remember. We are luckily a few episodes ahead of schedule now. So the problem is when I always say it's going to be ready by this, I don't know when this episode is going to come out. Yeah. For people who are watching this, Dre and I recorded this in 2015. okay. So
I actually came in and did it in 2018. So get your heads around that.
That's right. That's right.
God.
So my Wooden Dummy book, Wing Chun Companion Book 5 will be out. I'm super excited about it. And yeah. So anyway, shameless plug aside. My favorite books outside of the WT lineage and outside of like my own books, our good friend Chan Chi Man, he wrote a book with one of his students, the late Jose Ortiz, I believe his name is.
Tito Ortiz.
No.
Jose.
And it's called Wing Chun Keys. And it's the only book of Chan Chi Man's style there. Like the keys to the car, yeah.
Okay.
And it's a great book. It's a short little book. You probably have to go to everything Wing Chun to get it. So Wing Chun Keys, really great book. It has some history of Chan Chi Man in there about Yip Man. And he breaks down each form with like principles and ideas and stuff like that. And really, really fantastic. The book written by the late Sifu Moyat, Wing Chun Kun Kut. Where Moyat has the mottos in there, right? It's a very, very helpful book.
I heard of this book. Yeah,
that's a great book. You also have to get it from Everything Wing Chun as well. Those books are great. Let me see. I mean, for me, I try to buy all the Wing Chun books I can get because, you know, I'm just a nut about this stuff. And even from Sifus that I'm not particularly fond of, I'll buy their books just to see, because it's very important that you read. If you want to be an expert in something, you need to read stuff that you also don't agree with, because that's the only way you're going to strengthen your own argument. And sometimes you actually find, well, actually, I didn't look at it that way. And you can maybe reformulate the way you tend to view things. Let me see. I'm trying to, because I have a very extensive Wing Chun book collection at home. So I'm trying to go there. Obviously, David Peterson's books are really great. He has kind of his big Wing Chun book, but Wingtsun, where he has like a collection of essays. And that book is fantastic because it's got everything in there from like, you know, Wong Sun Leung's ideas on the different forms. There's history in there about Grandmaster Yip Man, all sorts of interesting stuff. Anything that David Peterson does is well-researched and well worth it. So I would say those are like three recommendations that I would give for books. Yeah, absolutely.
Lit legit. Moving right along, someone else we haven't heard from in a little while, Dryzen.
What are you talking about? We hear from him every week.
Is that so?
Oh, yeah.
I think he means that for him, 1 week is a long time not to hear his own, not to hear Dryzen say something.
Yeah, that's right.
So what does Dryzen have to say this time?
Well, Dryzen is asking.
Oh, by the way, I didn't see you and Dryzen in the last live chat, as was supposedly promised in the previous episode.
I was in the live chat for
yeah, but where was Dryzen? Someone. He wasn't around, huh?
I think he was commenting here and there.
Commenting here and there. Okay. Yeah. Good. Good to know. Receipts? Good to know.
Was that?
Receipts?
Yeah. He's got no receipts.
I don't have receipts.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
All I know is he chimed in. He's asking hypothetical. And he's asking, yo, Sifu, great podcast. Love your podcast. You the bomb shit.
Wow.
It's kind of ironic, I think, that there's sirens in the background when Dryzen's question is being read, right?
It's alarming.
As if somehow, you know, the gods know that some, you know, fuckery is afoot.
You're the bomb shit. And hypothetical. Oh, wait. Hold on. Misprint. Typo, I guess.
Got it. I want to see these questions written out. I think it actually has misprint. It's actually written in the question right there.
All right, let's say you're on your way to your school, City Wing Chun, on the subway, New York City subway. You're on the N train, and you're running a little late.
Hey, stop trying to give away where I live. not the M train, the nine. All right.
Okay. Yeah. Nine. Mm-hmm. The nine train.
Yeah. Got it.
He didn't write that though.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm just, yeah.
You're on
somehow Dryzen knows what train I take home. Yeah.
I'm
very
know.
Curious.
I, it's
this
weird.
This is getting a bit weird. You should
have
called the FBI.
Yeah.
So that sounds like he's stalking.
That's right. Is Dryzen stalking me? Why does he know all this stuff about me?
I don't know.
Right?
Seriously.
Yeah. I don't know. He's
story
right
is starting to fall apart in front of our very eyes.
You're on the nine train. You're on the nine train.
Yeah.
And you're on your way and the train starts to stall. And you're like,
pretty much grinding your gears. Pretty much happened to me on the way to the podcast today. But anyway,
you don't say.
Yeah. Funny how that came up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So random. So train stalling. You're like, Jesus. But you're in the station, so you're just like, you're two stops away. You notice that you're like 10 minutes waiting for the train to move, but you can easily just get out and walk. But you're like, you know what?
what's happening? I want to know what's happening. You look out, you see some dude fighting cops, and then they finally get him, and they get him down, they arrest him, and you're like, you know what? I don't have time for this.
I'm sorry, one second.
This is exactly what happened to me today. What are you even talking about?
I don't even know what you're
talking about. This is exactly what happened to me today.
This is what's written here.
This sounds like what I told you right before we recorded
today.
What's
written.
Yeah, it's eerily similar.
How so?
This is literally what happened to me today.
Dude,
Dryzen
wrote this in some time ago, I guess a few days ago after the Monday premiere.
Okay,
maybe
all
Dryzen
right.
Maybe Dryzen was the one being arrested.
Yeah,
maybe Dryzen has these hypotheticals based on his life experience with time machines.
Wow, okay, all right, let's hear this. I want to hear this, come on.
I'm curious too. Okay, I haven't gotten...
spit out this made-up question, let's go.
So you bounce, and you're like this. You start to go up the stairs to get out the train station. You get out the train station, and all of a sudden, you're on the set of Enter the Dragon.
My God, these time travel setups. Half the setup is just how I get into another time.
You
all right?
You like, what the heck? You're looking around. You see Bruce Lee. You see everybody.
Uh-huh.
Bolo, chest flexing.
Uh-huh.
And you look down. You have a gi on.
All right. By the way, for those of you listening to us on audio only, Dre has not actually looked at his computer screen for the last 5 minutes while he's quote-unquote reading.
I'm reading
this question. It's like he's just looking at me and acting things out.
I'm reading it.
No, look at his face. You can see the gears turning.
Yeah, that's right. He's like, yeah. And you're in a gi. Yeah. That's the ticket.
You're in the gi and you're with all these extras.
Mm-hmm. Wait, question, am I in a white gi or a yellow gi?
White gi.
Oh, so you, like the real piss extras, not even the tournament practitioners.
You look down, it's white, and then you look down, you're like, and it's yellow.
Oh, okay, all right, got it. So I'm one of the tournament practitioners because I'm in the yellow gi, one of the visitors, right?
All of a sudden, it's yellow, wait, okay. Oh, that's better.
Right, I like how the story morphs.
Dryzen suddenly remembered that he gave you mad props at the beginning of the
I mean,
question.
It's written right here.
Yeah.
Dude, Dryzen is good, man, with these, you got to admit it.
Yeah.
He's on point.
He's constantly changing time as the question rolls up.
Absolutely.
Dude, for him to like, maneuver that, like you look down as white, and then you look, you're like, what the hell?
Him,
you look down again, it's yellow.
For him to maneuver that.
Oh.
Yeah. No, it's cool.
He's genius.
Spit the question out.
So, you look down at your yellow gi, and all of a sudden you hear Han go, Richter! And you look up at Han, and Han is looking at you, and you're like, what was Bruce Lee's character name again?
Lee.
And Dryzen wrote Lee. Richter, Lee. And then you got to face off with Lee.
Mm.
All right. But you know Lee's the star of the show.
Right. Which means I'm going to have to lose or die.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Take a back fist or two.
Right.
But you know how to
defend a back fist. Right, okay. All right.
You teach us shit all the time.
Right. I teach you guys how to destroy the Enter the Dragon combo with super basic ideas.
This is actually one
of our training programs.
What
the whole
do?
Enter the Dragon versus Bob Wall sequence. How you can nullify that thing without trying.
That's what's written right up on the curriculum on the wall.
Yes.
I mean, you hold back?
Okay, so I'm in the End of the Dragon, and then I'm called to fight Lee's character.
Yeah.
All right.
Against these back fists.
Right. Okay, and then we're up there, like, basically I'm kind of like where Bob Wall was, right?
Yeah.
No. You know what I would do.
I know what you do, because you teach it to us.
Yeah, no. I'm going to go up to him.
Right.
We walk up there, we bow, and I'll say, hey, man. We can take this old man together. I go, let's pretend like we're going to start. All right. We're going to bum rush the old man, beat his ass, And then we'll go downstairs and take all the photos for all the evidence, because that's the whole reason why he's there. You know, I gather you don't have enough evidence to bust up his operation, right? Mm. We'll go get that evidence. All we need to do is beat that old man's ass right now, all right? And then we're just going to yell for... Wait, is Jim Kelly's character dead by that point already? I think he might
he's still
have...
There.
No, he's still there. No, he can't be still there.
No, I think in that point of the film, he had already been killed.
Yeah,
all
right? Right close to the end at that point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So right. I'm just going to be like, all right, look, you see that other whitey over there, that John Saxon looking dude, all right? Roper, all right?
Roper.
We're going to go, hey, Roper, let's take all these dudes down now. He killed your boy, and he killed your boy Williams, and I'll show you later. That dude already killed him, all right? Let's go take all these dudes out right now. And then suddenly, boom, it's the three of us, all right? It's me, it's Roper, and it's Lee back to back. And we just bum rush the old man, break his little hand off, slap him around a little bit, tie him up. All right. And we go run and we take the photos, and that's the end of the movie.
That's the end of the movie.
Yeah. That's what's up.
What?
Come on. How much cooler would it be?
How
much cooler would it be to fight side by side by Bruce Lee, right?
Yeah.
And he's so light at that point. Like, I'd grab him by the arms, I'd swing him around, kicking dudes. Like I would just grab him like you grab a kid, right? We just go around and we just taking all these extras out, like spinning around. Pop, 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 like this, like that, like a helicopter, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, pick him up, throw him into dudes, whatever. Yeah. He can push me into dudes and say, yeah, be great. Be great.
Alternate ending.
Yeah, man. How cool would that be?
Wow.
All right. And I would also be like, hey, isn't it weird how like the floor here looks like tennis courts? Because it was shot at the American Club on the tennis courts. In certain long distance scenes, you could actually see like the lines from the tennis courts where they were. It's kind of funny.
Woo.
Yeah.
Oh,
cool.
Good. And then would you say what's up to Jackie Chan?
What? Is he Jackie Chan in the movie?
I mean, he's not.
He's just an extra.
Just an extra. Would you say, what's up, Jackie?
I'd be like,
Jackie?
You keep your head up. All right, yeah. You'll do fine in the future as long as this guy dies. If Bruce Lee doesn't die, which now that I'm here, he might not die because I'll keep him away from those B-list, C-list Taiwanese actresses. So he should stay alive. I'm sorry, Jackie, but your career might take off a little bit later, all right? Or maybe I'll convince this guy to put you in a movie.
Would you tell him to go the comedy route?
Yes, right away. Make those
inside.
Taiwanese stinkers with low way, all right? Forget that, all right? Because he made a bunch of, like, super shitty Taiwanese films with low way. And that his career stalled for the longest time until he made... Snake and the Eagle Shadow with M.C. Yoon. So No, I'd be there. I'd be financial planning for everyone. Hey, Yoon Hwa, come over here, all right? Just so you know, you'll never make it as a hero, but you'll be the best villain, all right?
Mm.
And hey, Sammo, I got good news for you, all right? I would go there. Let me financial plan for you, all right?
Oh.
I'll tell them what films to not make in their future, all right?
Wow.
And Jackie would never have to make. You know, a couple stinker films that he had to make because he owed certain triads favors or whatever, because he would have never got locked into that contract with Lo Wei, you know, which he needed Jimmy Wang Yu to help him and stuff. Like, no, you don't want to have to owe Jimmy Wang Yu any favors, right? I would fix everything for them.
Yo, that's giving me idea to like find
another Dryzen question.
Financial planner that's from the future.
Yeah, no, that would be the best way.
Yes,
We could all use a financial planner from the future.
Yeah, ask Dryzen. He's bound to know somebody, right? Or does he just deal exclusively in the past?
I don't know.
And with Bruce Lee.
Oh, would you actually say hi to Sammo Hung while you were there as well?
Yeah, of course. I would definitely say. Although Sammo Hung is not in that scene.
No, he's not in that scene.
No.
He's got to be hanging around somewhere, we would like to think.
No, actually, he was in Thailand during most of the shoot of... Enter the Dragon, because they needed to bring him over to shoot, because the opening scene where Bruce fights Sammo Hung, that's actually the last scene that they shot in the movie. Because they didn't have like the movie kind of opened with him like in Braithwaite, like on the mission. And they just felt like, no, we need to showcase why Lee is such
too.
A badass, right?
Yeah.
So they actually shot that afterwards and put that in there. So that opening scene with Bruce is actually the last scene he would ever film for a movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ain't that some shit?
That's why he's even skinnier there than he is later in the movie. Oh, by the way, totally forgot about something. I think our very first or second question where the guy asked about the hash.
Yeah.
There was one thing I wanted to actually debunk in his question, which I totally forgot.
Yeah.
He said that Bruce Lee was 1% body fat. Okay.
Death.
You cannot be 1% body fat. Okay.
You would
literally, you would literally die. All right. Mm-hmm. Bodybuilders who sometimes get to like 4% body fat on the night of the competition, they are literally at death's door. All right. Because you cannot survive with that kind of body percentage. Single digit is already very dangerous. If you're at 9% body fat, you need to work really hard to stay there. Your body's not going to try to let you stay at that level because you need a certain percentage of body fat to function normally.
Your brain.
Yes. But if you're at 5
Heart,
and
brain,
sub 5, you're actually getting into really dangerous territory. Man, people, if you're at 7% body fat, you're going to feel like shit. 1% body fat, you don't live at 1% body fat. You don't live. You would be in a hospital if you were still alive.
Wow.
So anyway, I just want to say that, right? Talk to any, but you're not 1%. Someone said 1% body fat. That's crazy.
The lowest I ever heard was 3%, and that was, what's his name? Cheating cancer. Lance Armstrong. That's
Lance
it.
Armstrong,
yeah,
right,
he got
yeah.
down to 3% when he was at the height of his powers, which were not at all involved with taking all of the...
EPO.
EPO.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
And ruining...
No, it was natural.
Weight.
It was chicken and rice.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah.
All right.
Anyway.
So we got time for one more?
Yeah. Okay. Chris. Simply Chris.
Yes, Chris.
What are your opinions on the use of hooks and uppercuts in Wing Chun, and how do they differ from in use from boxing? How do they differ in use from boxing? They exist in the system, but seem so underutilized.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it also depends on the version of Wing Chun that you learn. In WT, we have the lifting punch in the Chum Q form, which is akin to an uppercut. And in the third form of Bugi, we have a hooking punch, right? Now, of course, you have to remember the context of which, you know, most Wing Chun practitioners are practicing their art. Someone is in front of you. Someone is getting in your face. You have your hands up. You're trying to de-escalate the situation. The person moves and you want to finish the fight very quickly, all right? We are not, and it always bears repeating, talking about you're dancing back and forth with someone and fainting and seeing how they react and go back and forth or whatever. If you're in a situation where your hands are up and you're dancing back and forth with someone and you're using feints to measure distance and kicks and seeing what's going on, I'll
you're
tell you something.
Fight.
No, you signed up for that.
Yeah.
All right. That is not a self-defense situation. All right. Now, as a martial arts nut, I'm also very much interested in training for and discussing that situation where you're going back and forth and, you know, how do you cleverly close the gap against someone who has boxing skills, evasion skills, kickboxing skills. But that is an entirely different conundrum than the dude standing in front of you looking like, what are you looking at? What's your problem? The guy's already in distance and the guy goes to take a swing and you need a very fast action to solve that situation. That is arguably where Wing Chun excels. And that is the main thing when people come to me. It's like they want to learn that, right? Okay, you want to go back and forth and do a kind of more sportive style fighting. That is a different situation. And that is something that from a legal perspective, you signed up for. And you're not going to convince a judge when you're going back and forth and using your jab to test his reaction and feints and stuff like that. Oh, no, that was self-defense, Mr. Judge. No, it wasn't. You're going back and forth with someone. You are a willing participant, okay? The difference between fighting and self-defense is that in fighting, you have two willing participants. In self-defense, you only have one, all right? So... If you're talking about creating a quick movement, a quick decisive action, then it makes more sense that you use things that are more efficient and not throwing a swing from the side. Although sometimes throwing a hook might be the best thing to do. We even talked about it like in my situation when those guys grabbed me, I actually used the Bugi hooking punch on both of those guys because that was the thing that made sense in that situation, right? But Wing Chun strikes are not just like boxing back and forth and, oh, I'm gonna throw a left hook and I'm going to pepper him up with this or whatever. The idea is that we're trying to figure out a way to finish the fight quickly and use things that make sense in that moment, right? I would agree that the hook punch and the lifting punch are a bit underutilized in Wing Chun because of this idea of always punching on a straight line, going down the center line. But often when we do a hook in Wing Chun, it's because we are 90 degrees to our opponent. Our hand is up here in the middle. And that hook punch is actually a straight line from our fist to our opponent's jaw.
Right.
So as it's not a looping hook, it's a short, tight, straight hook. So a hook in Wing Chun is really just a straight punch from the side. All right. The way a side kick is a straight kick from the side, right? And the lifting punch, if my hand is under and I give you a lifting punch or an uppercut, it's a straight punch from that angle, right? So I do teach use of those punches as well, but they're not used indiscriminately, like in just more kind of casual way of striking, right? It needs to make sense in that situation. It always bears repeating, and it's not about, oh, sport fighting, there are rules, and street fighting, there are no rules. That's never my argument. My argument is just, what kind of situation are you in, right? And people constantly conflate kickboxing, boxing, dancing back and forth with someone with what's going to happen to you when you're at McSorley's and some dude is a little drunk and getting in your face. This is a very different situation, right?
I love McSorley's.
So anyway, like I have no problem answering those questions, but I always have to remind people, what are you training for? Like, what are you envisioning is going to be your use of your martial art? You're talking about comparing yourself to someone of another style in a sportive kind of way. Okay, now you need to have elements of kickboxing, distance, timing, measurement, all that kind of stuff, using feints, baiting the person to come in if they're timid and so on, creating frames against someone who's just trying to run right through you or whatever. This is a more expanded topic of fighting in general. But for self-defense, it's always a very quick action.
Mm.
And that's all I got to say about that. All right, so I hope you liked that episode. And as always, if you have questions for me to answer on a future AMA, go ahead and write them in the comments below. Don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius and hit that bell for notifications. And I'll see you guys next time. Word is, I'm a Kung Fu genius. Technique speaks for me, not lineage. Forget Jet Li, cause I'm the one. Many call me Sifu, but to you I'm Seagung. And I produce masters, you surpassed us. Your Kung Fu stiffer than corpse and caskets. City Wing Chun is the house I built. Violate the gate and your blood gets spilt. Alex Richter, always the victor. The mic picks up everything.
Easy.
Yeah, and you hear it like a whisper in your ear.
Stop. Such an ass.
Yes.
Trey, I'm in your ear right now. Can you hear me?
No. What's that woman's name?
Who, what
YouTube,
woman?
The YouTube chick.
Oh, Tang Tang?
Tang Tang.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, the ASMR.
You could Tang Tang my ear right
now. Yeah. Hey, it's remarkably easy to do that. These people aren't doing anything special.
Rub yourself with pillows and shit. I've seen that.
Rub yourself with pillows? I don't want to know what ASMR he's watching.
Feathers.
They rub themselves with pillows. All right, go to it, Dre. Let's do
it. Right, peeps. The genius will be answering all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube.
When you said, oh, it sounded like someone was wiping your balls with a chamois leather.
They Jeez, were. Chamois leather.
They were. That's what I was imagining. Though.
God. Something comes out of Mikey's mouth. Balls with chamois leather.
It's all that from experience.
That was oddly specific.
Right. This is a new memory.
Who even says that?
This is a new memory.
This guy.
Yeah. Chamois leather.
All right, let's do it.
All right, peeps, on today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, the genius will be answering all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube. Let's get to it.
What?
Guy.
Lots of Wing Chuns and uppercuts. Wing Chuns and uppercuts. Wing Chun hooks,
Dre,
and uppercuts.
Dre.
Lots of gems. Lots of, I don't even remember what the hell I'm supposed to say right here. Lots of, yeah. Let's get to it.
That was amazing.
That was amazing.
That was actually amazing.
It's perfect.
Yeah, we should probably just use that for the opening.
Oh,